And welcome back to Canucks Talk. I started questioning myself about whether the beat would even drop. If I was like waiting for something that wouldn't happen. Thankfully it did. And so it goes. Welcome back to segment two. We're joined now by Vancouver Giants head coach Manny Viveros. Manny, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks guys. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us. So I want to chat with you, Manny, because your teams, whether they've been in, you know, Henderson or Swift Current, have always trended toward being relatively high-flying offensive teams. And what we're seeing so far from your Giants, no different than that. Second highest scoring team in the league on a goals per game basis. What's clicked for your group offensively this season?
Well, I think the biggest thing as far as, part of the misconception is that as far as that we're high flying, I think the biggest thing with our group this year, you know, having a second season with this team here, majority of all the kids being back again, is that we've got them to buy into of defending first. And by defending first or defending correctly, we spend less time in our D zone, and then we obviously spend more time in O zone. So that's where our skill set takes over after that. So, but we make sure these kids are, you know, understanding it for our group, which works for our group, is that if we're able to do that, we're going to create a lot more in the offensive zone by getting out of our zone quicker. So, but as far as the offensive part of it too, yeah, we've got some dynamic kids that can put the puck in the net if they're put in the right situations.
It's sort of the secret, right? That if everyone is willing to sublimate individual goals for the team, they also get more individual contributions, right? How tough is that to sell working with younger players?
Well, it takes time. And, you know, I've seen it at the American Hockey level, even at the NHL level too. Like, this is, you know, everybody wants to score a goal, but it's a process. It just doesn't happen. And it's got to start from somewhere. And on the other hand, also too, a big part of our creating offense or we call defending is by being aggressive on the forecheck. We've done a really good job of creating off our forecheck this year and able to sustain ozone time. And part of the message that we tell our kids is, you know, let's not wait to get in our zone to defend. Let's defend as soon as we lose that puck and get back as quick as possible. So, and we just reinforce it with video after with our kids, showing it when they're doing it right, how good and successful they can be.
The latest sort of rink product lighting it up in the WHL is obviously Cameron Schmidt leads the league in goals. But, you know, in the same vein of what we were just discussing, Manny, a lot of buzz around his improved two-way play. What are you seeing in terms of that improvement?
Well, as precise as a great example of Cameron this year, of coming in this year and really understanding, you know, what he needs to do if he wants to get to that next level. And we always say the 200-foot game. His game has been so much more responsible this year, especially in our D-zone coverage. For an example, he just doesn't fly the zone, you know, as he did as his first year as a 16-year-old. He's understanding that with his speed, and if we stay connected, he still has, he's still creating just as many or even more scoring opportunities from that. And, you know, I give him credit for understanding that and then, you know, absorbing that and using it in his game here. So he's been really good. A lot of his goals have started from our D-zone coverage, where he's been in really good position. And then when he gets his puck, that's when his speed takes over and his skill set.
You've got Mazden Leslie, second among defenders, scoring in the league with 19 points. You know, we know about Ryan Lynn and some of the other dynamic offensive defenders on your team. Is it similar for defensemen where the process is sort of what's driving this, or where has Leslie's success been sort of originating in your view this season?
Well, first and foremost with Mazden, we asked him and challenged him to come back this year in the best possible shape that he could. It could be, and it's not to say he wasn't in before, but he's taken his conditioning and the fitness level to another level this year. He came back and you can just see him maturing into, you know, into a strong young man. And plus you add that to his skill set, where Maz plays a lot of minutes. He gets about 25 minutes a night for us every night here. And he has that capability to not just play those minutes, but to be really good while he's, extending sometimes longer shifts than other players. And he's been really good. He's same with Maz. He's understanding too that if we get out of our zone first without trying to cheat the play or cheat the shift itself by trying to get out of the zone, we're going to be in pretty good spots. He moves the puck so well, then he also has the ability to escape a lot of that trouble with his feet also.
Now in your second season and with a group, a core group that's maybe a little bit older, a little bit more mature, a little bit more veteran, let's use that term. You guys have been able to, or your group has been able to clean up on home ice in the early going and, has even seen your offense spike a bit when you're enjoying that home cooking. What's been the key to how your group has sort of handled or capitalized on home ice at a higher clip so far this season?
I think for our group, all together as a whole, is just a maturation process. If they're a year older. Like last year, we had 10 players that were 17 and under, mm-hmm. and they were all rookies. So there was for them, it was just a big learning curve in that first year in the Western Hockey League, just kind of figuring things out. And so the second season, credit to the kids, they've come back in and they understand what it's like to be in the Western League and how hard it is or how good this league is, and the preparation involved, not only just on the ice, but off the ice too. And you can see tremendous strides in a lot of other young players also too. We're still, age-wise, we're still a very young team. I think we're probably the third youngest team in the league, but still, having said that, I think our maturation process is making our players, our older in years as far as experience. And I think that's so invaluable. You look at some of these players like Ovi Vafaio, who's out right now with an injury, or Cameron Schmidt or Jake Oreskovich, all these second-year players have come in and, they're not playing like second-year 17-year-old players. They're in here playing like they're 18 or 19-year-olds in this league. And that's something that is very encouraging for our group.
So putting it together, big test this weekend in Prince George. You're 3 points back of the Cougars, but you have games in hand. And obviously, I'm sure these two games loom large for you and your group. What's going to be the key to sort of passing this next test for your more veteran group this weekend?
Well, there's, teams like Prince George, we had Saskatoon in here last weekend also too. That's always, it's a measuring stick. Are we there yet? No, we're not there, we're not there yet, but our kids, we kind of, in the terminology we have, we want to be able to hang with the big boys, and that comes with consistency. It doesn't matter if you're playing at home or on the road. We feel as if we go in and we play the style of game that we play, and our attention to our details, that we have a really good chance here. So it's going to be a really good test for us. But our kids, I'll tell you one thing, from last year going in there, we certainly were a lot more intimidated. This year, I don't see that being a factor for our group here. They're going in with the belief that they can go in there and get points for sure.
Manny, best of luck in Prince George this weekend, and thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Manny Viveros, the head coach of the Vancouver Giants, off to a pretty incredible start to the season. All right. Open segment for the rest of segment two. If you want to use the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line and help us guide the conversation, whatever you want to talk about, I will rant on that subject until I run out of material. So, producer Lena, do we have any questions that have come in so far?
We've got tons, Rance.
Let's go.
All right. First one is, what do you think of putting Brännström with Hronek as a second pair? Brännström is mobile, which Hronek is used to playing with, and gives Hronek someone to feed him offensive opportunities. Then put Myers on the top line, where Hughes will control and stick Soucy with Desharnais for a little more stability with less minutes. Sorry, I read that really weird, Drance.
No, you know what? It's fine. At the moment they referred to it as the top line for a defense pair, I was kind of weirded out. So there's nothing you did that would have changed that equation, Lena. Look, I don't dislike the idea by any means. I have no problem with the notion that the Canucks should be experimenting perhaps a little bit more with their defense pairs. I mean, for all the changes we've seen, right? DeBrusque with Pettersson, DeBrusque with JT Miller, DeBrusque on the third line for a period. All the different permutations we've seen up front, all the different combinations we've seen on the third pair. Lankinen sort of becoming this team's starter after Artur Shelov's started the first game of the campaign. There have been sort of two fixed points, two North Stars for this Canucks team this season. North Star the first, very clearly, has been Hughes and Hronek. North Star the second has been Myers and Soucy. Well, the effectiveness of those two fixed points for this team could not be more disparate. This team is thoroughly dominant in Quinn Hughes's 5-on-5 minutes. This team is thoroughly dominated in Myers and Soucy's 5-on-5 minutes. Now, arguably, Soucy and Myers have trended a little bit better on this road trip, but we're still talking about the club's on-ice shot differential being 70 shots for and 81 against with Myers on the ice, and 53 shots for and 93 against with Carson Soucy on the ice. 5-10 goals for, goals against with Soucy on the ice, 6-10 with Myers on the ice. I mean, we're not at a point where the Canucks second pair is giving back all of the good work that the top pair is doing, but you can see it from here. And so fixing that issue, I do think is worth thinking through in terms of what it could look like and what options the club has in-house. The idea of Brännström with Hronek, for example, is one that I find appealing. Not, however, as something the team should go to right now, because right now, for all that the second pair is struggling, the top pair's results are so exceptional that the club can weather it. Right? Like, that's the thing. The top pair is not having their work from a goal differential standpoint given back by the second pair entirely. Moreover, with Brännström on the ice 5-on-5, the Canucks have outscored their opponents 8-3. So the way it's working now, you've got Brännström and Desharnais playing in very sheltered, specific deployments on the third pair. And that's enabled because, in part, the Canucks play the wheels off Hughes and Hronek, and in part because they're punting somewhat successfully these Soucy Myers minutes. Okay? If you start to reconfigure that, you change that balance. So Myers and Hughes have really only played together over the past, well, since they've been playing together, which really dates back to Hughes's first full NHL season, they've really only played together at length when the Canucks have trailed, right? It's not a pair that any coach has gone to as like a first choice matchup pair or a top pair. It's something teams have gone to when they want to break glass and sort of inject a little bit more offense into Hughes's minutes. And by the way, many of those minutes have been played before Hronek joined the team, right? But when it was Jordy Benn with Quinn Hughes or Chris Tanev with Quinn Hughes or what have you, right? Myers' offensive toolkit brought real value in those specialized situations. But the fact that Travis Green didn't see it as an option, Bruce Boudreau didn't see it as an option, and Rick Tocchet didn't see it as an option, and the number of things that all three of those gentlemen would agree on in terms of assessing defensive play. I mean, I think Green and Tocchet would agree on more given their friendship. But I mean, if three separate coaches have looked at the same problem and concluded the same thing, I weight that pretty heavily. Like, there's a reason why we haven't seen that. But if you went to it, okay, so now you're playing that pair in heavy minutes, just like you're playing, because obviously it's Quinn Hughes. You're playing Quinn Hughes heavy minutes, no matter who he plays with. So whoever's playing with Quinn Hughes, you're also playing in heavy, heavy minutes. Now it's Myers taking those minutes instead of Hronek. So let's assume that your top pair is 20% less effective, right? There's something about the Hronek-Hughes chemistry. I also don't think it's preposterous to say that Hronek's going to hold up on a top pair with or without Hughes slightly better than Tyler Myers. 20%. We're sacrificing conservatively 20% at the top of our lineup. Now we're throwing Brännström and Hronek into the sort of second pair punt role, Well, okay, so now you're playing hard minutes, matchup minutes, lots of defensive zone starts, heavy minutes, and you're doing it with Brännström and Hronek? Does that sound likely to work? And now, for our sheltered minutes, we've got Soucy with Desharné. Well, are Soucy and Desharné going to be able to blow the zone and change up where the game's being played and help drive some secondary offense the way Brännström has done on the, in those minutes? Or have you sacrificed your sort of sharp end of the spear even in those sheltered minutes, right? So I think where you get to with this particular suggestion, which again, I think is an interesting thought experiment, is like you've weakened your top pair. You've probably improved those second pair minutes somewhat, and you've weakened your third pair. And on balance, like, it might be better for the second pair, but it's not going to be better for the team on balance. That would be my guess. That would be my estimate based on sort of going through the exercise of what this team's options are. Now, where I think Brännström, Hronek is a really interesting thought, like where this becomes compelling to me, is the idea that there is an effect to having two high-end puck movers on the ice together at the top of the lineup and playing them ideally as a five-man unit with the JT Miller line in particular. That's what we're seeing the Canucks do with Hughes Hronek. It rules. We saw it last season too. It also ruled. By the way, we saw it the season prior, even before Filip Hronek was on this team. It's just that those minutes included Hughes and Bear. And it ruled. Where Brännström's emergence, I think, really could matter for this team, right, is over the last two seasons, Hughes and Hronek have combined to miss one game. And it was an elective where Hronek hung back in Vancouver as the team traveled to Winnipeg for game 82. Obviously, he wasn't 100%. We know that because we didn't see him shoot very much in the playoffs. And the club decided to give him a rest before the games really mattered. That's it. Well, if you ever had to play an extended stretch, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, without Hughes or Hronek, having a player like Brännström, especially with the way he's moving the puck and playing the game at the moment, who you could plug in for Hughes and or Hronek on that top pair, I'm not saying he'd be able to replace Quinn Hughes. In fact, I'm telling you right now he would not. I don't know that anyone would on the whole planet. And I'm including like your Devon Taves, Adam Fox, Cale Makar tier there. No one can replace what Hughes does for this team. And I'm definitely not saying he could replace Hronek either, by the way. But stylistically, he could at least step into those minutes and it wouldn't fundamentally alter what Vancouver's trying to accomplish with their top pair on the ice. In that way, the fact that Brännström can play either side, the fact that he can move the puck, the fact that he can do some pretty interesting things in zone at the offensive blue line, all of that, I think, gives the Canucks at least some insurance, right? There's an element to which, if you have Brännström crushing it in the sheltered role that he has over the last, whatever, 10 games since he got into the Canucks lineup, you're A, going a long way towards solving that non-Hughes minutes problem, which we've been talking about all season, but also he raises, I think, the floor for what you can do in the event that your worst case scenario happens and you actually have to cobble together, you know, a Hughes or Hronek replacement for a matter of 4 or 5 games or a week or two. Would the seam show if you needed him to do it for 2 months? Oh, yeah. But it's an answer that he gives the team that they haven't had. And it's something that longtime listeners will know. I've been talking about, frankly, for a year. Like, this was the sort of piece that I thought the Canucks should probably bring in at the deadline last season, just because, you know, I thought the Hughes-Hronek impact was so significant that the club should maybe make some moves to be protective of that dynamic, given how important it's been to this team's success over the last, you know, season and a half. And so that's sort of where I like the idea of Brännström Hronek as like a break glass in case of emergency option, where at least the Canucks could tactically try and replicate some of what's worked for them at the top of the lineup, even in a world where they had to, you know, limp through a stretch without one of their star defenders in the lineup. Lena, let's go to one more.
Is Dante Fabbro considered a top for D-Man. Seems like his name's always out in the trade rumors, and it may be time for Nashville to move on from him. Would he be an upgrade on our D-Core, and would dealing Hoglander be enough to get him? This is from Patrick, the ice cream man.
Yeah, you wouldn't deal Hoglander to get Fabbro at this point. Fabbro is a third-pair defenseman in Nashville. He is 26 years old, Coquitlam native. He is in the last year of his deal, so he's an unrestricted free agent beyond this season, so he'd be a rental player, whereas Hoglander has that tidy three-year, $3 million extension already in hand. Obviously scored 20 goals last year, is still 22, and, you know, has cost certainty, or sorry, he's 23, just turned, yeah, he turned 23. Anyway, he's 23. Point being, Hoglander is younger, more valuable, and has a more impressive recent track record of both usage and production. They'd have to add significantly to get Hoglander. And, like, significantly, right? Like, Fabbro market value, I think you're looking at mid-round picks, probably. You're probably looking at a couple of mid-round picks. I don't think the value would be significantly different than what we saw Timothy Liljegren go for. Maybe a little bit more because his contract expires. And it's less than $3 million. But yeah, no, Hoglander would be too much at this point to pay for a player with Fabbro's profile. Fabbro is not an everyday top four defenseman. I don't know that he would be an upgrade over Tyler Myers necessarily in the top four. He certainly hasn't done it as often as Tyler Myers has, or frankly as well. So I think you'd be looking at Fabbro more as like in the Desharnais role, which I don't think the club would do proactively, right? I think Desharnais is going to get a fair bit of runway here to show what he can do. And by the way, I thought he played pretty well in Anaheim. Like, he had some interesting moments, even jumping up in the play. He had a nice interchange with Nils Hoglander, set up a scoring chance. I mean, not that he's been consistent. I think that's sort of what I'm still waiting for from Desharnais. But when you see the physicality play, when you see the penalty killing, and when you see how well he fits with Brännström, when you see how well he can take advantage of the space created by a puck mover, like, the experiment, the big dice roll, the big swing that the Canucks have taken bringing in Desharnais on a relatively luxurious two-year deal to sort of gamble on him, you know, you can see it. Like, you can see the seams of the bet that they're placing a lot of the time. And in my opinion, more than half of Desharnais' minutes, I've been watching with, you know, my eyebrows kind of peaked, being like, hey, yeah, I like that. Hey, there, that's, I can see it. Then there's the other minutes, right? And that's sort of the thing. And, you know, I think we saw, especially early on in the year, and especially I think whenever he's played with, you know, for whatever reason, Forbert and Desharnais, for example, has just not worked to my eye. But those Brännström minutes, with some inconsistency aside, I think he's looked really good. So, you know, I'm not even banging the table telling you that Fabbro would be a big upgrade on Desharnais. Maybe a little bit. I think his puck skills are a little bit more developed, but he's certainly not as big, and he's certainly not as impactful on the penalty kill. So, you know, I think it's a wash. I don't know that Fabbro makes a ton of sense, frankly. The guy that stands out to me would be Jeremy Lauzon, right? Jeremy Lauzon, $2 million per, 2 years left. Doesn't get much more talk it than Lauzon. Lauzon is trusted in harder minutes. He plays more like 19 minutes a night. And importantly, Lauzon plays both the left and the right side. So he'd bring a ton of versatility, right? That would be more like an Ian Cole replacement, right? Now, Ian Cole, I think, is a sharper. Like, Ian Cole's, I think, one of the smartest two-way defensemen, frankly, that I've ever seen. I'm not saying he's a star player. I just think he's brilliant in terms of the way that he moves the puck, in terms of the way he feels pressure, his timing, his defensive game. I know it all fell apart on him in that Edmonton series, and, you know, he basically was a moving backboard for the Edmonton Oilers to bank pucks off into the net on. But, you know, he was hurt. I think there was significant issues, like getting his gear on and off, from what I understand. I mean, you know, I think judging Cole solely off of that and ignoring all the great stuff he did for this team would be a mistake. So anyway, I still think that's something this team is missing. Just like a really sharp defensive defender like Cole was, who did such a great job for this team last season. Lauzon would be more in that mold, not quite as sharp as a thinker, but physically assertive to the nth degree, like really fits the Tocchet template, and we've seen him handle larger minutes. I guess the issue that you bump into there, though, is one that's not dissimilar, I think, from what you're seeing with Soucy and Myers and what you've seen from Forbert and Desharnais when they played together, which is that Lauzon, ultimately, his best minutes have come with Alexander Carrier on his right side. Like, he's not a guy you necessarily want moving the puck either, right? Like, he's not a guy who's going to do it alone. And given the composition of Vancouver's other defenders, you know, I just don't know that Lauzon in and of himself is really what you want, nor is Fabbro. Like, I think what this team's going to need, if they're going to bring in another defender here, if they're going to spend on another defender here, especially given the dearth of options, is a guy who can play Tocchet's game, but also bring something transitionally to a second pair, right? Like, if you got to a world where you were able to play Soucy Brännström on your third pair, you know what I'm saying? And there was like a, I'm just going to bring up a name, but like a Marcus Pettersson type, like a guy who can play the defensive role and handle and eat those top 4 minutes that have been something of a struggle for this team, but can also help you key the rush in and of themselves, who can be the complement, the puck carrying complement to Myers. Like, that's the sort of thing that I think would be worth paying for. I don't know that Lauzon, nor do I think that Dante Fabbro necessarily match that description. They're hard to find, and they're going to be expensive to land. All right, before we go, I just want to remind you that it's time to celebrate the return of hockey season with McDonald's Canada's game day deals. Satyar Shah and Dan Riccio give you the chance to score a $100 McDonald's gift card on Canucks Central that you can use to get a Big Mac, a McChicken, or a Filet-O-Fish game day deal for just $4 tax on any Vancouver Canucks home or away game day this season, only through the McDonald's app. Download the McDonald's app to score great deals and earn my McDonald's rewards towards free McDonald's. All right, now that you're all craving a fish fillet, we'll be back on the other side and joined by Dmitry Filipovich on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Hello, and welcome back to Canucks Talk with Thomas Drantz, and now with more Dmitry Filipovich. We'll bring Dmitry in shortly, but first, let's pay the bills. Dmitry and I are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And of course, if there's anything you want to ask me, if there's anything you want to ask Dim, get at us using the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at dunbarlumber.com. Dmitry, how are you, my friend?
I'm good. My second appearance on Canucks Talk this week. Jamie better be careful.
Yeah,
this is any more time and he might not have a seat to come back to.
Poor guy.
He's going to get Wally pipped.
You know what? I think he's bored to tears at home. I know he'd rather be doing the show and... Jamie, I got bad news for you. New co-host, Dmitry Filipovich.
The new host of the Hockey PDO cast, Jamie Dodd.
Oh, boy. Anyway, the Canucks play the Kings tonight.
Yep.
And the Canucks are actually favored on the money line. And you know, not massively, but minus 125 plus 105, which feels like a little bit of disrespect for the Kings, I think, more than it suggests respect for the Canucks, especially because when you look at like Pacific Division futures, the Canucks are still behind, have longer odds to win the Pacific for a second year in a row than Vegas does or than Edmonton does. Mm-hmm. Why is the market cool on a Kings team that's performed this well to this point in the season?
Maybe it's because they listened to us on Canucks Talk last week when we were pretty critical of just being disappointed by their like lack of improvements offensively, and for all the speculation and promise that this year was going to be different, we weren't seeing it. Now, to their credit,
and then what happened?
Well, since then they've played really good games. They had just recently come off a good game against Vegas at that point.
Yeah,
but since then they played two really good games on the road back to back against both the Predators, where they just completely shut them down, and then the Minnesota Wild, where I think they won 4-1 as well.
Yeah, 5-1.
5-1. So they're coming off a really good stretch here. They're playing really well. I just think it's ultimately a sign of either respect for the Canucks or just not knowing what you're going to get from the Kings. Because I think we've seen, like, before this stretch, they lost to the Blackhawks. They lost to the Sharks. Like, we've seen the highs and lows that they're capable of. I think it's just an acknowledgement of that probably more so than anything. But I feel like it probably should be a coin flip at worst for them.
Only the Oilers and the Hurricanes have controlled a higher percentage of shot attempts and shots than the Kings have. They're outscoring their opponents by 10 at 5-on-5. That's one of the best rates in the league. And they haven't relied too much. I mean, they're shooting, they're running a little hot offensively, but they haven't relied too much on good fortune to achieve it. That Mikey Anderson Gavrikov pair is looking elite, like genuinely elite. Brant Clark is kind of killing it. I mean, I don't want to fall victim to the, hey, well, now they've played four good games in a row. But it does feel like this has the profile of a team that at the very least I think has like separated itself in from the Seattle Kraken in the early
goals. Yes, and before that, Quinn Byfield had been struggling as well. He finally got off the stride and scored his first goal as well, which is huge for them. Brant Clark, I think you're kind of underselling it. You said he's killing it. I think he's been playing really well, though, especially of late. Like, he started off the year making a few mistakes, just to be be expected considering his sort of bump up in role and responsibility, but he's a legitimate offensive driver for them as well. Also, I know you've noted this, the Kings, for whatever reason, gave the Canucks a lot of trouble last year in their meetings as well. For whatever reason, just like the depth and pace they were able to play at, I think made the Canucks a little discombobulated and stretched them out defensively a little bit as well.
I also think it was that they were both so committed to playing a low variance game.
It was just a rock fight. Yeah.
Yeah, that it was just a rock fight. And then the Canucks were losing to, like, you know, the Kings should be a 45% chance of beating that Canucks team last year, like the relative strength of those teams. But I think it was truly just 51% versus 49%, and the Canucks just lost three straight coin flips. Like, that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's correct. I think your point is definitely well taken, though, about the Kings certainly vaulting themselves above that Kraken tier. And
yes,
I think getting pretty close, if not already there, to the top of the Pacific, which is a low bar to clear, in a sense, because when you look around and compare it to other divisions, I think it'll be a bit of a different conversation. But yeah, certainly they're in that Canucks, Oilers, Golden Knights tier as well right now. And,
yeah,
and the Kraken, I think, are way behind that at this point.
Yeah, it's too bad. They've kind of flatlined. I mean, so I think the thing that makes this Kings team belong is Mikey Anderson and Gavrikov. For me, that's like going to be such a key thing to monitor today, especially because the Canucks are almost certainly going to go out and self-match and try to play Hughes with Hronek and Miller, right? So, like, Hughes and Hronek will self-match to the Miller line, and they're going to try and use that five-man unit, and the Canucks need to put up goals in those minutes because their second pair, we know, can struggle. And if it's going to be Deneau against Miller, then we're going to see some Kempe. We're going to see some guys with speed playing, you know, minutes against Desharnais and Soucy and Myers, and we kind of know what that can look like. So for me, that's going to be the key matchup here. And man, Gavrikov and Andrew, like, I honestly think they've been one of the, they're not Hughes Hronek level all around dynamic, but in terms of just a workmanlike, annoying to score on, generate more than they surrender by a lot pair, I struggle to find one that I'd rather have other than Hughes Hronek in the Pacific Division.
Well, it's very vindicating to see as well, because Mikey Anderson has certainly been playing at this level for a couple years now, but considering how just tightly matched all of his minutes were with Drew Doughty, I think there's some, not some skepticism, but I think generally a lot of the praise or recognition for that just went to Drew Doughty because of his sort of stature around the league. And now seeing him with Gavrikov, who's a really good defenseman in his own right, but isn't necessarily Drew Doughty, I think seeing him sort of continue that success is nice to see. I think also the forward group, the way it's constructed, at least in theory, now that Byfield's playing better, they've got the Kopitar-Kempe combo, right?
Yeah.
Then they could throw Fiala and Deneau at you, and then this sort of Byfield Fogel line, which just comes with like just endless amounts of speed and downhill ability, it's pretty tough to contend with because you're not really going to have a lot of shifts off there. And as you mentioned, with the second pair for the Canucks struggling in totality this year, that's a pretty, if they ever get sort of matched up head to head with a combination like that, I feel like the Kings should feel pretty good about their ability to sort of push the pace and put the Canucks in another uncomfortable spot.
Yeah, well, and that's sort of one of the main things I'm looking at. So I want to do this exercise now, Dim, for the rest, because, you know, the Canucks are playing the Kings tonight. They're playing the Oilers on Saturday. Mm-hmm. The Oilers and Vegas just had a pretty entertaining game last night with the Oilers kind of coughing it up, I would say, in the last 10 minutes of the third period. And so I feel like it's a good time to do an update, just like an overall Pacific Division update. And I know how closely you watch the division. You know, I moonlight as a Seattle Kraken's beat writer, so mm-hmm. I'm always watching the Pacific. I figured this was a good time to do it. So I wanted to build tiers with you and like really get into sort of a team by team on where we think they're at. Now, I want to start. I'm going to do standings and then we'll do our own tiers. Okay. So currently it's by point percentage, Vegas 1, Vancouver 2, LA 3, Calgary 4, Edmonton 5, the Kraken 6. No, sorry. Oh my goodness. The Ducks are 6th, then the Kraken, then the San Jose Sharks. Yikes. It's been ugly for the Kraken, eh?
Yes. Whew. You should know that as someone who covers them on a day-to-day basis.
That is nasty business. All right. Tiers-wise.
Yep.
How would you do it?
So we're starting up top?
Start at the top.
I know this is going to be a bit of a cop-out, but I would put the three teams that we thought heading in, the Golden Knights, Oilers, and Canucks, still in a tier of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get into the individual cases for them.
Is there any team, would you consider putting any of those three teams above the other two? Because I probably would.
The Oilers fastball, still in theory, I think you saw last night what ultimately did them in has plagued them all year. And that's even with McDavid back. It's a bizarre lack of finishing, which I think we both don't necessarily expect to continue based on the talent there. But also sort of
5.82%.
Yeah. It's like, and a guy like Hyman, who was probably most negatively impacted by that, already gets like a nice little bounce off the end boards there to score a goal last night. He's going to certainly start scoring more. Is like the defensive breakdowns that I think we've become sort of synonymous with the Oilers over the years at very inopportune times. And that's ultimately what hockey is. It's a game of like finishing and managing breakdowns and like making sure they don't come back to bite you. And the Oilers right now are kind of getting the worst of both of those worlds. So if they can just start finishing a little bit better, I think it'll cover for a lot of whatever those defensive flaws that remain are.
So I'm of two minds here. Like the one thing about the Oilers, my inclination is to put the Oilers in a tier of their own because I think they're the best team in hockey when they're on. The problem is, like where I'm bumping into an issue with the Oilers when I watch them play this season is I think they're slower. Like, I don't think their offseason made a lot of sense. Like, you lose Broberg, you lose Holloway, you lose McLeod. To me, you've lost all of that, like, supporting warp speed depth that you had. I mean, Holloway was basically the only standalone offensive driver aside from McDavid. Like, everything else flew through 97 in the playoffs, especially after that Canucks series. I mean, Dreisaitl was such a monster in that Canucks series, but I also think he got banged up so badly early in the series that he wasn't the same after it. So it was like really the McDavid show, and then Holloway was occasionally able to do some cool stuff on his own, and it was kind of that. Like, that was kind of it. It was what you get from McDavid and what McDavid supports and then what Holloway was able to do. I worry that because of like a couple gaffes, a couple silly mistakes from McLeod, that they kind of like underrated how important McLeod's speed was and Holloway's speed was, and maybe overrated like Adam Henrique scoring a couple clutch goals in game six. And I just worry that they've made themselves a little bit too slow and blunted the edge that made them special last season. What do you think?
That's fair. I will say, though, like not only the finishing, but specifically having a bottom five power play so far.
Yeah.
Is just something that just doesn't make sense to me. So
you just think a lot of what's ailing them is Mirage?
I think so, certainly. Like, once they just start scoring goals to the level that I think, regardless of their team speed, they're going to get because of the talent level at the top of the lineup, I think a lot of this is going to become a bit of a moot point for me. I don't think they should be at least right now until proven otherwise, in a tier above Vegas, though. Because not only just based on last night's result, whatever, I think the Oilers did get the better of the play overall. I think this Vegas team can hang. Like we saw in the playoffs last year against Dallas, I know they ultimately blew that series and lost in Game 7, but they were right there with a really good Stars team. They're healthier this year, at least for the time being. The top of the lineup can certainly play with anyone, right? That Eichel, Stone, Barbashev line has been arguably the best top line in hockey this season. I like their blue line. I think their power play is absolutely elite. And as we've spoken about with them in the past, any tier projection kind of right now taking stock of this should note or account for the fact that Vegas is certainly going to add one more star player, right? They're uniquely positioned to do so because you look and it's like, all right, they're up against the cap. They don't have much draft capital. How many teams in their position have guys like Nick Hague, Zach Whitecloud, and Nick Waugh, who are all awesome players, and especially like Nick Waugh, I love him. I think he's wildly underused just because of their center situation. But these are guys who are like in their mid-20s, who are making around $2 to $3.5 million that another team would look at, especially a worse team than Vegas, and say, yeah, this is a legitimate trade chip because we can bring this guy in and just bump them up higher in our lineup because we're not as good as Vegas up top. And so all of a sudden now, I think they have a ton of trade flexibility, actually, which seems amazing considering how many trades they've already made the past couple of years because of those guys. Like very few teams, if you look at the Oilers, for example, they just don't really have those types of players slash salary slots to facilitate any sort of big move without like dipping into prospects and draft capital. And so Vegas is going to add another star. It sort of remains to be seen who it's going to be, but there's no way this is going to be their team past the trade deadline, and it's already a really good one. So I do think Vegas, just projecting ahead, belongs in that top tier.
Yeah. One other thing that's sort of interesting about Vegas is because their team build is so shy on wingers, right? Like every year we see Jason Zucker for like a fifth at the trade deadline and on and on. So it's like the specific thing that they need feels like it's going to be most abundantly available once you get down the stretch, whereas it feels like every other contender is going to need defensemen. And, you know, I still look at that Liljegren trade as like a canary in the coal mine for any blue line shoppers out there. And by the way, that's basically every contender except Vegas. You know, if that's the cost of a reclamation type guy on a bad contract today, like, man, you're say Pittsburgh decides to sell Marcus Pettersson, like, good luck.
Well, it's a great bet on their part because as we talked about heading into the season, I think they sort of acknowledge that they're deep down the middle and on the blue line. And so where they had to cut costs was on the wing. And so their bet was we're going to bring in a bunch of these sort of lottery ticket young guys who have at least finishing ability and we can sort of insulate them. And so when you look at their underlying profile at 5-on-5, like the shot chance expected goal metrics aren't
great.
As high as they used to be.
Yeah.
I would wager that at the end of the year, you're going to look up and see that they've outscored whatever their expectations are by a pretty significant margin because top of the lineup moves the needle there. And then they're going to have guys who like don't have good possession metrics, but score like Dorofeev, like Olofsson when he comes back, even Holtz to an extent. And yeah. So I think that's
I thought Holtz was really good yesterday. He's always been a guy that's left me wanting. One of those like wet noodle players that fans can never understand why coaches don't play them in more minutes. And then you watch them struggle to pick pucks off the wall or watch them struggle to make reads in lanes away from the puck. And you're like, no, this is obvious. Like this guy has a lot of work to do. I thought he was awesome. Super involved, super physical last night.
He was, and Dorofeev all season has been unbelievable. Like he's almost transcended to a different tier in this conversation of those guys.
You know
he's pretty clearly a guy, all caps letters.
Yeah. A G-U-Y.
Our G-U-Y.
All right. So I think you've sold me. So we're going to go one tier, Vegas, Edmonton, Vancouver. I need you to order them 1, 2, 3.
Oh, man. Well, I'm Edmonton, Vegas, Vancouver in that tier. But I think it's very closely linked. I feel like you still have a bit of skepticism or reservation about that. I feel like you probably, if I gave you some truth serum, you'd have Edmonton pretty comfortably, or at least relatively speaking, above those teams.
Yeah.
I think it's all a jumble. And similar to what I said about Vegas, like the Canucks are clearly not a finished product, not necessarily personnel-wise, although we'll see on that, but just playing style-wise, like the adjustment is very evident.
I think truth serum, I'd go Edmonton, Vancouver, Vegas. I think if I had to today, that would be, but I think you're right. 2-3 for me, very close.
Yep.
And Edmonton close enough ahead that I'd at least consider putting them in a different tier. All right. What's next? Where do you put the next tier?
Well, it's LA, and then it's a bunch of teams that I don't even think are warranting tiering the rest of the
way. I disagree. We're completing this. But I think you're right. LA is clearly in their own tier.
Yes.
And I
much closer to the top tier that we just said than anyone else below them.
Could they bump into the top tier? If Brant Clark keeps playing this way and Byfield, who's controlled play well at least, gets hot.
Doughty comes back.
Yeah, what's it going to take for LA to jump into this tier?
I think I just need to see them offensively show more like initiative and ambition than they have in the past, right? Like, I think that's why you're going to see these highs and lows, because they can stagnate so easily offensively and have performances where you're just left wanting more. And so I think ultimately it's just going to be a trust exercise in terms of like needing to see it for at least a couple more weeks before feeling comfortable there. But certainly personnel-wise, I think they have all the talent necessary to be in that tier. And what helps all these teams in this conversation is that it's so lean beneath them in this division that you should theoretically be able to clean up and pad your point totals at a point where you feel pretty comfortable in the second half, not having to worry about your positioning.
So I think my problem though, Dim, is that's my concern about Vancouver, and they've improved in that respect, but LA's improved in that respect too. Like, in some ways they've taken a similar route to get here. No? Is it as simple as just trusting Vancouver's high-end core more?
I think, yeah. I mean, they clearly have more elite functional firepower at least, right? Like, LA does on paper. We just haven't necessarily seen it translate all at one time, whereas Vancouver we have, with Hughes, Pettersson, Miller, and Besser all playing at their at their sort of peak of their powers.
Is Calgary in the next tier with Seattle?
I think you have to put them there. Obviously, from a talent perspective, it shouldn't be. But you watch them play, and I have to give them credit. Like,
yeah,
I know it's kind of a cliche thing, but like they battle really hard. You even watch that game against Montreal, where they probably should have not been behind in the first place based on the flow of play, and like just bouncing back. And then Coronado had just an unbelievable hop on my back sequence, right, where he like solo effort to tie it up late in regulation, and then within seconds of overtime, brings the puck down and scores a second goal to win it. They're not really out of any of these games. Even the game they played earlier this season against Carolina, where Carolina just threw their fastball at them, they kind of absorbed it and then punched back a few times and made a really entertaining, hard-fought third period for the Hurricanes. So the Flames aren't going to be an easy out. I know I just said that teams like the Canucks and Oilers and Kings should be able to clean up against the likes of them, but individually within those games,
yes,
the Flames are going to be a tough out every single night.
I think the Flames have a couple crucial things that make them annoying, right? Like, they have just enough good defensemen that can actually handle tough minutes. They have Mikael Backlund, so it's going to be a miserable night for your top line center. And then they have enough like guys like Zeri who can annoy you because they're skilled, right? Enough Colemans that can just like bring it so that you better be on your game. You can't have like an easy shift against them at any point. And then enough guys like Sharon Govich, where if you're not, you know, when he's in the lineup, where if he's bigger than you, it's just too hard to get the puck off him, right? And then you combine that with like a serviceable power play, right?
Competitive goaltending.
Yeah. I will say too, I think Huska's done an excellent job. I don't know that we're talking about it enough. Like, their game plan against Vancouver that first game, in sort of spurring that comeback and just like peppering Shelov's from the point and just trusting that it would break if they kept doing it. Like, I just thought there was a lot of like discipline shown by that group, and obviously a smart game plan too. And every time I watch them play, I see more evidence that they're attacking teams the way I think those teams should be attacked. They're like passing that test on an almost every game basis.
Well, there's been a couple examples, and that's probably the best one of it, where a bad team or a team that we thought would be sort of a rebuilding, potentially even tanking team down the stretch.
I thought they were going to be terrible.
If you get blown out early on, like you give up a couple goals, you just look like, all right, we're just facing a much better team tonight, and that's going to happen to them quite a few times this year. Generally, those teams just fade into the night, right? They're like, all right, we're going to take our lumps here. Let's just, you know, try not to get too embarrassed, but we're not actually going to try to push back and win here. And they don't do that. Even when they lose, they give you something to think about the rest of the way. And so I think players-wise, obviously, but I think coaching, you're right, deserves a lot of credit for that.
Kraken, skidding. I think they'll finish ahead of Calgary, by the way, but...
Probably, yeah. They just need to play Joey Decord every night.
They don't have any backup goaltending. It's crazy. All right, and then I want to make a take here. I want to have a take on the bottom end of the Pacific Division. I am going to put the Sharks in a different tier than the Ducks.
Yeah.
I think the Sharks no longer offend me.
The Ducks are embarrassing, man.
The Ducks are embarrassing.
Watching them against the Canucks the other night.
Well, especially because they started okay for like 7 minutes. Their speed could have given Vancouver's problems if they'd actually played to it.
Yeah.
And then they just didn't.
You messaged me about this. You're like, I like what they're doing off the rush early. And then I'm like, I looked up and they had 0.2 expected goals for the entire period, for like halfway through the second period. I'm like, they haven't generated much.
Yeah, well, it all came at the start. There was like 6 minutes where I was like, okay, this is interesting. I hope they play. I hope they keep attacking the Canucks this way because that could make for an entertaining watch. And then they played chip and chase hockey for 30 minutes. And guess what happens when the Anaheim Ducks youngsters play chip and chase hockey against Rick Tocchet and the Canucks? The Canucks destroyed them.
Well, I know this is the case anytime Quinn Hughes is on the ice, pretty much against regardless of the opponent.
Yeah, but I've never seen him have that much space up high to operate.
Well, on the goal, certainly. But I feel like at any point you could have looked at your laptop or your phone and then looked back up on the screen and just assumed the Canucks were on a power play.
Yes.
Because they had that much control in the offensive zone and that much space to navigate. And then you start counting and you're like, no, there's five Ducks out there. This is even strength. And it just did not look like that.
When you watch the Sharks play two now, there's at least like a good healthy quotient of, oh yeah, that guy. Oh yeah, that guy's an NHL player. Like that guy's pretty good actually, right? So you have the Zetterlund minutes, you have the Toffoli minutes, you have Wenberg minutes, you know, like the Jake Walman when he's been in the lineup, right? Like Liljegren helps there too. CeCe, I think, is a like big ad for them, just in that, you know, look, we know what it can look like in the playoffs until game seven when he becomes Reggie Jackson, but the fact is that it's just like at any given point, the Sharks at least have like four credible experienced NHLers on the ice, which is a massive difference from last year. It was like 10-1 and you were watching them to see like how bad could it look.
Yeah.
They at least feel like an NHL roster now. And, you know, we've only seen Macklin Celebrini play twice. So I actually think they're ability to level up even from there is pretty high.
They just give up 51 shots to the Columbus Blue Jackets at home, though.
But the Blue Jackets are playing good hockey.
They are.
Yeah.
But they made them look incredibly imposing offensively, and so I'm with you, but I don't want to get too carried away because I feel like the reality of the season is going to sink in at some point.
This is more a slight to the Ducks
than
it is praise for the Sharks. Like the Ducks are... I'm no longer interested or curious in what they're offering.
I've sold all my stock. I'm off the island.
Yeah,
I'm flying back home.
I'm selling low. I'm happy.
I'm dumping it on the waiver wire. We can't get anything back for our Duck stock.
Yeah, it's bad. All right. We're just holding. All right. That'll do it. Those are our Pacific Division tiers, just to recap. A tier of three at the top. LA in their own tier coming in fourth. We've got Seattle and Calgary. And then we've got San Jose and the Ducks in a nadir tier all their own.
This is your heaven, Drance. You got to tier and you're going to do a draft next segment.
Are we doing a draft next segment?
Well, you kind of have can. To, no?
It feels weird. It feels like we're cheating on Jamie.
Yeah, we need Jamie to do a draft. Maybe we can call
That's
him.
That's fair. Let's call him.
Yeah, let's call our sick friend. Anyway, we'll be back with more of this on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Hello and welcome to the final segment of today's episode of Canucks Talk. I'm here again with Dmitry Filipovich. We're going to kill 25 minutes here.
If you're not pumped to hear us, I don't know what's wrong with you after the way you went into break saying we're going to be back with more of this.
More of this. Well, we can't do any more tears.
Do we have any mailbag questions?
Yeah, we definitely always have.
There's tons. And there's also a lot of people saying that we should still do the draft and draft foods that make Jamie moan sensually.
Oh, God.
It's like any meats. I feel like all of his food drafts are like so nutrient dense.
He's a big protein guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you heard this, but like he had a moan on the segment. And
Really?
It was so weird.
You haven't heard it?
Was I on with you guys when this happened?
Do you guys have the drop?
Let me find it. Pull it up.
It's okay. Well, here's one. Here's one that comes in from James in Calgary.
From Jamie Don?
From Jamie texting from his sickbed. No, from James in Calgary. Who says no to the following trade proposal?
I like it already.
Vancouver sends Elias Pettersson, Nils Höglander, and Vincent Desharnais to Buffalo for Cousins, Bowen Byram, and Zach Benson.
Oh, I was right about to say the Canucks in a heartbeat, but then you tossed in Benson there.
I still think, okay, first let's play the moan because it's a really fun
hypothetical. Yeah, buy me some time
here. Yeah. But you...
when did that happen?
I don't even remember. We got confused about something and Jamie
amazing.
Lost his mind.
I feel like the Canucks, they know. I feel like there's just so few players of the caliber of Elias Pettersson when he's the full potential version of himself. I know it's frustrating that he hasn't been that in a while, but it's still obviously clearly there considering his age and how recently we've seen it from him. That I feel like when you have those players, you never really want to downgrade into like getting a bunch of lesser pieces to do so. Like the Canucks, if anything, need to keep stacking towards getting more Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson types than like getting a deeper supporting cast and downgrading at the star level.
For sure.
So I say the Canucks say no there.
Yeah, I agree. With the Canucks, we're getting a lot of questions too about the Canucks power play and why it's been stagnant over the course of the season. And look, the actual results aren't that bad, Dim, right? Like it's not great, but it hasn't been killing them by any means, although it obviously is frustrating on a game-to-game basis. I mean, 16.7 is not great as a conversion rate, but it's like 22nd. You know, you're a goal away, basically. Like, you go 1-for-2 or 1-for-3 tonight, you're back to league average, right? So it's not been that bad.
I think it's because once you combine the second half of last year or whatever after the All-Star break, then it drags it down a little bit and builds the sample size. So I think that's why people are probably...
Well, yeah.
More frustrated by it?
I also think, so let me give you the rundown. By shot attempt per 60 rate, the Canucks have finally peaked above 80. 80.91 per hour shot attempts. Only the Philadelphia Flyers, no one is worse, but the Philadelphia Flyers are the only other team below 90.
Hmm.
So it's really just them. The Canucks are also dead last in the NHL by shot rate. Only them, the Blues, and the Edmonton Oilers are below 40 shots per hour. But the Canucks are worse of those three. So last in attempt rate, last in shot rate. And, you know, they're shooting 14.5% on the power play, which is fringes of the top 10. And they're still at 16.7%. So I actually think the fan sentiment that, like, this is really bad is actually sage in this instance. Like, I think Canucks fans have identified something that's...
Yeah, before the bottom drops out.
But I think the bottom's going to drop out if they don't massively improve it. And look, there are signs. Like, they were at 75 shot attempts an hour and, you know, below 35 shots per hour just a few games ago. So they've done better against the Ducks, against whom they went 1-for-5 on the power play, and the Sharks, against whom they went 0-for-2. But still ugly.
Yeah, especially since it's so intertwined with all of the angst about Pettersson.
Right.
I feel like it's like two birds, one stone there.
Yeah,
and so
right.
I feel like if that wasn't the case and it was just the power play, then you'd feel more comfortable with like, all right, well, we can work on it or we can salvage this. But because it's so linked with Pettersson's struggles, in particular, his sort of lack of interest or willingness to just uncork one-timers and making them so stagnant and predictable as a result of it, I feel like that's why there's so much angst among fans. And also... so kind of obvious, I guess, what the fix is.
Mm. With
him just shooting more one-timers.
Pettersson?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, he's not even in that spot all that regularly. Like, I don't know. I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer for what's going on there. I guess you're a more neutral observer than most of us who are engaged in this Canucks-centric online conversation 24/7. What are you seeing from Pettersson in terms of why this fall off has happened?
Yeah, without like psychoanalyzing too much, it just feels like it there's just a noticeable lack of sort of juice compared to when he's at his best. Now, the issue with that is I feel like out of any player in the league, he might be number one in terms of worst at hiding when he's not feeling it, right? Like, just aesthetically, his sort of confidence in his game or how he feels he's playing is so directly transparent on the ice to like what he's trying to do and how he looks. And so when he's struggling like this, it only just makes that issue that much worse, and there's no hiding it. I know you and Harmon have noted that, you know, his skating spurts are down, the zip on his shots is down, and so both of those things, I think, tie into this. I'm surprised that he hasn't been more productive in the minutes that he's played with Garland than he has, because I would have thought, in theory, for a player that's struggling and has generally had too much burden on his plate to create a 5-on-5 in the past, giving them someone who's playing as well as Garland is, but also how puck dominant Garland is, that it would free him up to sort of lurk in the shadows, find soft spots in the ice, get a few easy tap-ins here or there. And those have been few and far between as well, right? There was the one goal he scored against the Penguins on a play like that, but for the most part, we haven't necessarily seen that translate. So I think that's been sort of a very concerning development here, because I would have thought that the one natural fix would have been just play him with Garland and kind of free him up a little bit, and that hasn't necessarily had the results you wanted.
Yeah, 13 minutes though, Suter, Pettersson, Garland together, and the results anyway are pretty good. Like it's only been two games, but 19 shot attempts for, six against, 80% expected goals according to MoneyPuck. Now, a lot of that is the Ducks effect. Yeah. So we'll have to wait and see. But you know, it does seem like there's at least some early returns that look auspicious from that line, and it makes sense in your head because I think both Garland and Suter can kind of drive on their own. Like I think you've now got Pettersson with kind of two drivers. But what's sort of interesting to me, Dim, and I'm curious to get your take on it, like Hughes is still playing, or Miller is still getting the lion's share of the with Hughes Hronek minutes, and more than anything else dictates which Canucks players control play, it's who gets the Hughes minutes. And then also, and I think as sort of a corollary or attached to this, is, you know, Pettersson's something like a 38% offensive zone start clip, whereas Miller is at like 60.
Yeah.
How much of that is shaping some of what we're seeing too?
For sure. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, anyone that plays with Hughes right now is going to have a fun time, and then all the minutes without them is going to be much more of an uphill battle. How many games have the Canucks played so far? 12, 13?
13. 12, 12, sorry, 11. They played their 11th game against. This is their 12th tonight.
Okay, so I've been doing this since, what, 2012? I've never seen a defenseman play 13 games consecutively or 12 games consecutively the way Quinn Hughes has a 5-on-5.
Yeah.
Like, if you just look at his metrics right now, do you ever recall seeing that? I'm sure there were a couple Lidstrom seasons probably during peak Red Wings where he was in the low to mid 60s, but
so here's the thing. I have seen defenders have this type of impact
when it's on, like, a sheltered third pair.
No, or that, or on really bad teams.
Right.
So teams where there's like nothing else going right, like I'm talking like Brian Campbell in 2013 on the Florida Panthers,
right,
or Christian Ehrhoff in 2014 on the Buffalo Sabres, where you've got a competent puck moving top four caliber guy and everything else is so bad that like the team's at like 52% control, right, with him. And so it just looks like they're just floating all boats, but the team's bad, like miserable. What I've never seen is an individual defenseman have this kind of impact on a good team.
Yeah.
That's where this becomes wholly unique.
Yeah. No, I completely, and especially with the usage as well, right? Like how many minutes he's playing now. He's going to hit 300 minutes for the season, I believe, tonight, and or get close to it. And he has still yet to take a single penalty this year.
Jeez.
For the second straight, like I thought he elevated his individual shot rate to an unbelievable degree last year from the year previous. And he just did that again. This year, he's gone from like 11 to 16 to 22 shot attempts per hour for the year. I mean, it's not being talked about enough because he won the Norris last year. I think we're getting a little desensitized to it, at least locally here. And then also because he doesn't have the points that Cale Makar has so far this year. But I've just never seen these types of impacts for this long of a period of time without any real sort of slip-ups or games where it's not like that. Like, it just night to night, he's doing it every single time.
So today over at The Athletic, Dom Lecision wrote about Hughes being the back-to-back Norris winner, and he pointed out this. With Hughes on the ice, the Canucks have earned 65% of expected goals. This is what Dom wrote. A mark he didn't hit in any 11-game segment last season. That's led to the Canucks outscoring opponents 13-4 with a lot of great work without the puck in particular. The Canucks have only allowed 1.94 expected goals against per 60 and 1.13 goals against per 60 with Hughes on the ice. That gives Hughes a plus 2.5 defensive rating in his model, good for sixth in the league among defensemen. He then notes that Hughes also currently ranks fifth in offensive rating. He is the only defenseman in hockey to currently rank top 10 by both the offensive and defensive sides of his model. The caption here is, can Hughes be a back-to-back Norris winner? And I still think that's underselling him. Like, I am honestly at the point with this guy where I think to compare Hughes and Makar is to fundamentally misunderstand Hughes's impact. And I do think we need to be leveling up. Like, we should be talking about Hughes for the heart. The guys he's competing with in the early going are Kaprizov and Kucherov and company. He's already left Makar and Haskin, and at least if he maintains this level, he's already left that Adam Fox, Makar tier behind, no matter what sort of the hockey watching public that goes to bed at 11 or the betting markets say.
Well, and I have to admit, like, I just had it all wrong as recently as even last year. Like, my take all along, regardless of how the two were individually playing, was I thought Makar should be ranked higher in whatever list because his physical abilities, just because of his size and like pure skating pop and shot.
The shot making is
allowed
insane.
Him to transcend whatever environment. Obviously, he was in a great situation playing with MacKinnon on this sort of fast paced rush team. But I thought that regardless of any team you put him on or whoever he played with, he would be able to transcend it and keep doing Cale Makar things. Whereas Hughes just didn't have that in his bag because of those relative limitations. Since then, though, I feel like the reason why Makar's minutes without MacKinnon are always being sort of graded so poorly, one is because the players he's playing with when MacKinnon is on the ice are generally AHLers because they've had so many injuries to all of their top nine forwards, essentially, but also because he needs to play that sort of up and down north-south MacKinnon hockey to get the most out of his skills. Whereas now we're seeing with Hughes, I feel like, regardless of who he plays with or whatever you need him to do, whether it's push the pace or cycle the puck in the offensive zone and have these sort of long drag out possessions, he can do it all better than anyone else. And so it's interesting how, like, in my mind, I feel like the dynamic has flipped a little bit.
I just think the level, it's about what you weigh, right? Like, Quinn Hughes has closed the gap in terms of being a shot maker and upping his shot volume, but he's never going to be the shot maker that Cale Makar is. Cale Makar might be the best shot maker from the back end that I've seen since, well, probably ever from a skilled perspective, but certainly since Shea Weber, right? I mean, that's the tier of finisher.
I thought you were going to say since Sheldon Surrey.
Well, Sheldon Surrey was also sick.
He had a couple unbelievable seasons.
Dude, he was amazing.
Yeah.
But like, Shea Weber is the, like, yes. for 15 years, he was the best percentage driving back end finisher I've ever seen, right? Cale Makar is at that level. Plus, he rushes the puck. Plus, you know, he's got a mean streak. He's like a mean physical hitter in the defensive zone. He just does not exert the same level of control over the game. Like, he has MacKinnon, and MacKinnon drives.
Mm-hmm.
And in Vancouver, Hughes is MacKinnon. I'm not saying he's as good a driver as MacKinnon is. I'm just saying he is.
Yeah. He functionally plays that role, yeah.
It's different. It's like, it's a material difference. And I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take. The problem is I really do think you have to be watching a lot to really understand this. Like, you can have the stats nerds tell you the numbers or show you. Like, fundamentally, you need to be watching enough and waiting the right stuff. And I just think that's too big an ask for the public to get to.
Well, and Quinn has obviously his own fair share of highlight plays, but like, when Cale Makar pops, it's
he makes such a fadeaway shot.
It's such an obvious
seen.
Thing
yeah.
that you can appreciate just tuning in or seeing a clip on Twitter, right? Whereas Hughes' impact is much more cumulative over the course of a couple shifts, period, game, now 13 game stretch or whatever. Like, it's just, you're right. You need to watch it all from start to finish to appreciate it, whereas Makar's is much more segmented.
Yeah. I keep talking about Four Nations as like this moment where if America and Canada go head-to-head and he is the best defenseman on the sheet, I feel like that could begin to usher in an understanding for people. You know, I mean, if Canadians in the East Coast are finally watching Quinn Hughes, you know, with their hands over their eyes, being terrified about what's coming next, because that's, you know, what the sort of influence Quinn Hughes can have on a game. I think that's where, I think that moment can open eyes up.
Especially with all due respect to the Canucks forward group, I feel like if you have Quinn Hughes out there with Austin Matthews and Matthew Tkachuk, for example.
And Brady Tkachuk? Tkachuk Matthews?
Sure.
I'm now obsessed with a Tkachuk.
I just feel like they might have the first ever recorded 100% possession rate. Like, you're just never going to have the puck against them. I don't care if you throw out McDavid and McKinnon together. It's just going to be impossible to wrangle the puck from those guys, and Quinn Hughes playing with them and extending those possessions and working the cycle would be a sight to behold. So I hope we do see that.
Yeah, I hope we do see that as well. So just to finish us off, right? Where don't use the Jamie drop. Where we're at with this Canucks team, right, through 11 games, and what you've seen of them, and you're watching a lot of the other teams in the league. I think you're a little more dispassionate, again, than most of us talking Canucks hockey on these airwaves. So I'm curious to get your take on this, because it's like, for me, I see this team that at no point have I come away from one of their games and thought to myself, like, wow, that was a great performance. They look sharp. But I'm coming away from the totality of what I've seen thinking that their ceiling's probably higher than it was last season, and not by a little bit, despite the fact that they haven't put it all together. And in fact, the fact that they haven't put it all together gives me more confidence, because some of the stuff that's ailing them just feels like stuff that will be tightened by the time it matters in the spring. And, you know, you add that to a much higher baseline, that's when you start to cook with oil. What's your take on what you've seen from the Canucks so far, and what matters about where this team's at for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I'm willing to, and you mentioned kind of more from the outside, not necessarily living and dying with every single result. I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt of a longer runway or a longer leash to sort of iron some of this stuff out. I do think, as we've discussed in the past, there's a bit of an imbalance between this idea of how they wanted to play this year versus how they chose to construct their blue line, or yep, whatever they did this past offseason. So I think that's lingering in the back of my mind, but it's going to take some time, because it's such a fundamental tactical shift that they're trying to implement here with relatively the same core, that it's going to take some games, and you're sort of seeing some of those breakdowns and miscommunications and unsureness in terms of where everyone should be at all times that can be explained away in the results. Obviously, if this continues another 15, 20 games down the road, then I'll be much more concerned. But especially after last year, where you saw, like, they got off to such a great start, everything was going their way, and then they essentially spent the second half of the season sort of coasting, and part of that was the regression, but I think part of it was also the motivation of it being difficult to keep sort of caring in game 67 when your playoff standing isn't in doubt. I think it's fine. Like, I don't think their playoff situation needs to be cemented here in early November. I think it's okay if you take some losses along the way, as long as the process makes sense for a bigger picture view. It's clear they bumped into whatever ceiling they were going to bump into last year because of the way they were playing, and it could only get them so far. I do think this elevates that, and that's what they should care about most, right? I don't think finishing first in the Pacific is the end goal here. It's trying to get past the second round of the postseason, getting out of the Pacific and competing for the Western Conference Finals, and I think this gives them unequivocally this playing style a better chance to do so.
Yeah.
Especially against teams with firepower that they're going to have to go through in the playoffs.
Yeah, you go through the growing pains in October and November, who cares?
Yeah.
Right? If you can't manufacture shots when it counts, we see it in the playoffs every year. The teams that are dead in the water are the teams that stop generating when they finally bump into a team that has their number 5-on-5.
And as we said, if there's going to be any team or any division to do this in, it's the Pacific.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you can still skate by, hang around that third, fourth seed in the Pacific, and still feel very comfortable that your playoff spot isn't in jeopardy. Whereas if you were, especially out east, it would be much more precarious.
Dimitri, thank you for joining us. Everybody listen to the PDO cast on the Sportsnet Radio Network to get more Dimitri in your life. Thank you for having me solo on Canucks Talk, although Dimitri gave me a huge primary assist today across this week. We'll see if we get Jamie back tomorrow. No promises. Might be one more show of Canucks Talk to Yourself with Thomas Drance. Anyway, thanks for joining us. See you here tomorrow. You've been listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.